We're talking about the psychology of color here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Colors and emotions are all connected. Colors send our brain a message, and we make decisions based on color, like which bananas to buy, since they all have just a little bit different color variation. What colors are stimulating or calming to you? Is there one color that dominates throughout your home? Do you work in advertising or graphic design? How do you approach color in your work? What do you tell your clients about the colors you choose for their products? Join in on color, 800-642-1234. Karen Schloss is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology in the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison, where she leads the Visual Learning Lab. Karen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. I just realized I said the Visual Learning Lab. It's the Visual Reasoning Lab, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay, sorry about that. Well, give us some historical reference, if you would. What is the origin story for people using color to communicate different things in our world?
So color is a fundamental aspect of how we communicate. So in the natural world, color is used to signal information. As you mentioned in your introduction, we know which bananas to eat, partially because which ones are yellowish as opposed to greenish if they're not ripe, or brownish, meaning they're overripe. Animals signal with colors to indicate which ones are poisonous and which ones are maybe sexually receptive. This is a part of our evolutionary history, I would argue, is that we can use color to signal information. Also, people's facial coloration changes as they experience different types of emotions. So this can also be a social signaling cue. But in the work in my lab, we focus on human-created design. So how we use color to communicate information in things like graphs and maps and diagrams. I think probably the most obvious example that's familiar to most of us is traffic lights when they change color to indicate stop or go. And so that's something that's a highly learned association that we use in our daily lives if we're driving or walking.
And certainly weather maps have been with us for a long time. I'm so eager to ask you this question. When you look at the pandemic case spread maps and you look at those color variations, what do you think of the color choices going on in the COVID maps?
I think they're great. So there's a couple key issues that we want to think about when we're using colors in color maps, like weather maps or these COVID maps. One of them is that people have a dark is more bias, where if you don't give them a legend or a label, they will infer that darker colors mean more. So in these, at least the maps that I've been seeing, they're using this yellow, orange, red progression where darker colors indicate more cases or more deaths. And I think based on the evidence in my lab and from others, that kind of mapping is intuitive to people. So if you're emptying the dishwasher or doing laundry and you just glance at the TV for a second and you see that map, you're quick to know what that mapping is. And so I think if they would have done the opposite mapping where the lighter colors map to larger quantities, then it would have actually been less intuitive and people might have misinterpreted the maps early on.
It's fascinating that it's just intuitive for us to think that darker means more cases, more intensive cases. Why is that?
We don't know. It's an excellent question. So one possibility is it has to do with, I'm going to say ecological statistics. So the way density happens in the world. So as you're adding more ink to the page, the ink is getting darker and darker. But you might be thinking, well, if you look outside the window right now, you can see as the snow's falling on the dark asphalt, it's actually getting lighter and lighter. And so the dark is more bias operates when colors don't appear to vary in opacity. So that's a little techy, but basically there are cases where we do infer that light is more, but there's a specific way colors need to vary in a color map for that to happen. And so we don't know where these come from. One possibility is these ecological statistics, but another possibility is that it's learned. So back in the early 1900s, there was a commission of statisticians who decided they wanted to standardize ways that we visualize data. And from what I've read, it sounds like there was really heated arguments. Statisticians can have very heated arguments. they cannot agree on anything except to make dark map to larger quantities. in these kinds of maps. And so if it's the case that that was standardized, it's of course, it's not perfectly standardized now, but if that's been in the visualizations that we've been looking at throughout our lifetimes, it's possible that we've actually learned it from exposure. So to really get at that question, what I would love to do is go to a population who is not used to looking at human-made maps and see if they also have the dark is more bias. And that would help us get at this question of whether there's something about this ecological statistics of our environment that's shared among all humans, or if it's something that we've learned from looking at these human-created visualizations.
We're talking with Karen Schloss, who's an assistant professor of psychology at UW-Madison, where she studies visual reasoning, including how color aids in communication, how to navigate virtual environments for education. We're talking about these COVID maps where you can see case spreads. What have you learned from maps? Are there colors that make you feel certain ways? How necessary is color coding in your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Karen, how did you wind up in the field of color science? How did you become a color researcher?
That's a great question. And I can go through the personal trajectory or the science trajectory, but I think the personal one is a little interesting. So very, very brief version. When I was like three, my favorite activity was organizing crayons. Like, dolls were not interesting to me at all. My big problem was that if I had my set of 96 crayons, how could I put them in an order that made sense on the floor? And you can't do that because you need three dimensions to organize color, not two. And so I basically was constantly defeated and found this fascinating as a three-year-old. And so throughout my life, I just have been really fascinated with exploring color. When I was in high school, I was crocheting purses to pay for my Pilates classes, where I was playing with like how you could organize different colors within a crocheting sequence and how the colors look different with other colors around it. And when I was creating these for different people, I was making them for my friends, different people wanted completely different sets of colors for their own bag. And so I was like, why is it that we have these individual differences in color preferences? And why is it that colors look different depending on which colors you surround them with? So when I went off to college, I tried to find a way to incorporate color into every aspect of my studies. So I was a psychology major and an architecture minor. And so I was learning about the perception of color at the same time as I was being exposed to these principles of design through my architecture courses. It became clear that I wanted to be a scientist and I wanted to understand how we infer meaning from color and why people have these differences in color preferences and where color preferences come from in the first place. So that's what I think drove my pursuit of color in science.
There's a lot of things going on here. Is our brain hardwired to see certain hues, or could this be a path to understanding how each of us is unique?
So there's great questions. There's the question of what we see, and then there's the question of what we interpret when we see it, and then there's the question of how much we like it. So in the typical human visual system, color vision is pretty consistent across people. There's, of course, it's a philosophical problem. We have no way of knowing when I see a particular blue if you're seeing the exact same blue. And there are individual differences in color perception somewhat. But I would say the serious individual differences, at least that interest me, is the interpretations we have from colors and most critically, color preferences. And the idea is that your experiences with color shape your associations throughout your lifetime. And so every time you see a color co-occur with an object, so that ripe banana or the wall of your bedroom growing up, or for me, the fuchsia throw pillows on my grandma's couch, we form associations throughout all of these experiences, and those come to inform our affective reaction to color or our color preferences. So we've developed something called the ecological valence theory, which is with Steve Palmer back in Berkeley.
And I want to pause here on that theory as we talk with visual cognition researcher Karen Schloss. We will be back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. In If you're just joining us, we're exploring color here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Colors tell us things without saying a word, right? Shutterstock's 2021 Color Trends Report is informed by the pandemic. A rich, natural palette that speaks to new opportunities or a desire to get outside is where we're headed. Think browns, taupes, dark greens, rich yellow golds. What colors speak to hope and optimism? Do rich, rust-colored hues or a deep golden orange beckon you? Have you painted a room a soothing color? What did you choose? Mine is cerulean, sky blue. I painted two rooms during the pandemic, both in this color. Join in on color, 800-642-1234. Karen Schloss heads the Visual Reasoning Lab at UW-Madison, and she's our guide. Let's bring in Amy from River Falls. Hi, Amy.
Hello. How are you? How are you doing?
Doing well. What would you like to say about color?
Well, thank you so much. I've been fascinated by this discussion and by Dr. Schloss's work, and just wanted to share a kind of funny map that you've maybe never seen. I'm a geographer, and I teach at a community college in Minnesota, and in the human geography class I'm teaching right now online, just a few days ago, I incorporated into my lesson a map by an organization called Transparency International, which is an index that they create called the Index of Perceived Corruption of Countries Around the World. And what's fascinating about the way they code it is that the numerical rating is counterintuitive. The higher the number, the less the corruption, because there's a numerical rating that goes from like 0 to 100.
Mm-hmm.
So the higher the number, the lower the corruption, and the lower the number, the higher the corruption. But then the color coding is also counterintuitive. It's that the higher the number, i.e. the less the corruption, the lighter the number. And the lower the number, meaning the more corruption, the darker the number. The darker the color.
Darker the color, yeah.
Ruby reds for countries that have very low numerical ratings. And it's really confounding for students to try to make sense of it. And so I just thought that would be fun for Dr. Schloss to learn about.
I'm looking at the map right now, and it is completely not intuitive to how I would see color. Karen, what do you make of that when that is flipped around in a way in our brains?
I love this question because you literally just described an experiment that we're collecting data on literally right now. Like the slots are posted and participants are doing research in that right now. So this is a fascinating problem that can arise when more of the thing that you want to represent maps to smaller numbers. And so because of this index that you're describing, the smaller numbers mean more corrupt. And so then you have this question, should the darker colors map to the numeric values, or should they map to the concept? And what we're finding is that we do this with fictitious alien animal sightings, not with real data. So there's these little maps of alien animal sightings on the planet Spiral, because most of our research is on the planet Spiral, because we like not have preconceived notions about something like corruption, which I think does probably have a strong association. And so what we find is that it's actually the concepts that matter as opposed to the numeric values. So if you were to give those maps to your students and not tell them what the numbers mean and just ask them, where's there more corruption? My guess is that they would get the answer right. And then you run into this issue of smaller numbers meaning more corruption. And that's a separate issue of confusion from the color mapping aspect of it. And so that might be even a fun exercise to do with the students, is give them a new map that they haven't seen and ask them where is there more corruption and see if they do pick the darker regions or the lighter regions. But my guess is that they will pick the darker regions. And then that's a springboard for a discussion of, okay, but now notice these numbers are smaller. So what does that mean? Does that mean it's less corrupt? Well, actually, this is a weird encoding system where smaller numbers mean more corrupt. And so I think that's a useful springboard for a discussion about how we encode different kinds of quantities of different kinds of concepts in different kinds of quantities and how that can be counterintuitive.
Amy, thank you for that. We're talking with Karen Schloss, assistant professor in the Department of Psychology and the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison. She's explaining color science this hour with your insights and questions about color. 800-642-1234. John is joining us from Sabin this morning. Hi, John. What is your question?
Hi. I was wondering, because you started out talking about yellow and blue, which is the native royal colors of the Rothschilds, this generation is green, gold green, carbon neutral. Money grows on trees.
And so
we
make associations, I think, with certain colors. Karen, do we make those associations when John is saying, well, green is money, or maybe green is to recycling?
Yes, we absolutely do make those associations, but not just those associations. We make associations with green, I would argue, and some evidence suggests, every time we see it. And so the idea that a single color maps to a single meaning, I think, is limited. And we want to think about the degree to which green is associated, yes, with money and yes, with the environment, but it's also associated with trees, and I guess that's environment, and slime, if it's a yellowish green. And so the idea is that as we move through the world, we're constantly forming these associations, and different ones will be relevant in different contexts. So if you're looking at a graph about money, then it would make sense that you would encode green to indicate money. But green can mean lots of different things depending on the context. And so I think it's really important to think about the full range of associations that we have rather than one specific thing. I think of red as a great example for that. If you think about it, like a deep saturated blood red, it's associated with, that color is associated with blood. It's also associated with UW-Madison. It's associated with strawberries, and it's associated with ripe roses, and it's associated with wounds, bringing back the blood. And so our preferences for a color, we have evidence, are determined by all of those associations throughout our lifetime, which explains why we have individual differences in how much we like different colors.
I keep thinking of you organizing your crayons as a toddler. And, you know, I know it's been said that the prolific Dutch painter Rembrandt may have suffered from flawed vision. What can visual artists teach us about color science?
Oh, visual artists have known so much about color science probably before color science, just from their, well, not just from their deep explorations with color. I think one of my favorite examples of this is how colors look different depending on the surround. So Chevreul was a chemist, actually, and he was creating dyes for fibers, for weaving, for things like for rugs. And people would come to him and they would say, you know, I start using these particular threads and they look fine on the spool. And then I put them in the context of all of these other colors and it completely dramatically changes the color of what it looks like. And so he then spent all of this time exploring how and figure out kind of the rules of how colors look different with different types of surrounds and how that influences our experiences of harmony. So I think visual artists are amazing observers and translators of what they see, and we can learn a ton from them.
Yeah, they certainly can teach us. Daryl is joining us from Couderay this morning. Hi, Daryl. What would you like to add?
My question is, the state gemstone for Wisconsin is the agate, Lake Superior agate. And I'm wondering how the colors and the lines form in stone like that.
Yeah. Where do the color formations happen in these stones? Karen, any insights?
Oh boy. So when we see color, what's happening is that there's light being reflected or emitted from surfaces that then stimulates the photoreceptors on the back of our eye, so that they're light sensors. And then that signal gets processed and ultimately gives us our conscious percept of a color. So if the question is what's going on in the visual system that makes us see those colors, that's one question. But I think the question is about the physical properties of the mineral, and that I am not an expert.
That is for the geology department. Yeah.
But that emphasizes, so color is such an interdisciplinary field, which makes it so fascinating. It touches on, it's central to so many areas. And that's, makes it really fun to be able to talk across, across disciplines with different people, because they really do, use color in their own work in very different ways. So geologists, I'm sure, are using color in very different ways from the way that I'm studying it.
We're talking with UW-Madison color cognition researcher Karen Schloss this hour. Do you associate different colors with different things? How do you think they picked red, yellow, and green for stoplights? Do you have a favorite color, or maybe you have paired color preferences? Have your favorite colors changed over the decades? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Karen Schloss on color right after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about all the color we see in our world, how it affects us, informs our decisions. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Why do we have color preferences, and where do they come from? How are they formed? Why do they differ so much between us? Especially when we're trying to settle on the color to paint the tiny bathroom, maybe the nursery. Why do our color preferences seem to change? Be part of the conversation, 800-642-1234. UW-Madison Assistant Professor in the Psychology Department, Karen Schloss, is our guide. She runs the Visual Reasoning Lab, and she's a color science researcher with us for the hour. Let's bring in Lucas in Elk Mound with a question. Hi, Lucas.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So my question is, I'm a high school teacher in a metals lab, a woods lab, and we're in the process of redoing and going to be painting everything. Is there a color that's recommended? Our school colors are black and orange. Right now we don't have that incorporated, but we'd like to instill a sense of, you know, pride within the school or in the classroom, but I also want to have some motivation and engagement. But I'm in an industrial setting, you know, so I'm in a lab situation. Are there colors that are I should maybe avoid, or colors that I should try to incorporate?
Lucas, thank you for that. What would you suggest, Karen?
That's a great question. There has been I have not done this work. There has been work on colors in the classroom, and it seems pretty controversial, and I don't know of a concrete recommendation that comes from that. I think that if you want to incorporate that aspect of school pride in those school colors, I think it's a great idea to, and this is my not my scientific recommendation in terms of design, but we do know that people do feel pride in their school colors. So incorporating those colors as subtle accents, because I think painting the entire room those colors might be a little overwhelming. So you may be using a more neutral color, but then using them as some sort of stripe or some way to bring in that aspect of school spirit, I think could be fun, but that's not my area of expertise.
Lucas, thank you for that. Are there colors, though, that motivate us, or colors that are seem to be more positive or upbeat?
So I think this also depends somewhat on individual differences in terms of the particular associations that an individual has. That doesn't mean that we can't create public spaces that are positive and upbeat. But one example of this, that this is an anecdote, but it illustrates the scientific principle, is that the idea that we form these associations. I was chatting with my lab mate in graduate school, and a lab upstairs had painted their their office this beautiful deep teal color. And we knew from data in our lab that on average, people really, really like that teal color. It's associated with mostly very positive things, which does predict color preferences. So I brought my lab mate upstairs and I said, let's put this in our lab office downstairs. And he was like, oh, no, we can't do that. I was like, what is the issue? On average, people like the color. When they come into the space, they'll enjoy it. It's associated with calmness. We don't know if it'll make people feel calm, but at least it's associated with that. And he said, no, that was the color of my doctor's office where I used to get vaccines.
Oh, dear.
And I associate it with going to the doctor, and I don't want that color in my workspace. And I was like, got it. We will not get. Let's pick another color. And the point of the story is that although there can be average preferences and average associations, there are personal individual experiences that that can influence our associations and lead to those types of reactions. And so I'm hesitant to make a global claim that this color will lead to this particular outcome.
Yeah.
When you paint your walls that color.
Well, way back in the 70s, researchers were looking at this and they found that primary colors could affect your heart rate and your blood pressure, your respiration. Is there still ongoing study of this?
There is. And I think the question really ends up largely being about what aspects of color are having the effect. So you started off at the very beginning of this hour about this idea of yellow being happy and blue being sad, and how our lab is saying, maybe not so much. Lighter colors are happier and darker colors are sad. And yellow on average tends to be light and blues tend to be dark. This is partly because of the physiology of our visual system, that the most vivid pure yellow we can see is light and the most vivid pure blue we can see is dark. And again, that's from the physiology of how our visual system works. So then if we're going to say, well, light colors are happy and dark colors are sad, then if you're going to get the most vivid color that's light, it will be a yellow, and the most vivid color that's dark, it will be a blue. But if you were to make those colors equal in lightness and in purity, then there's no difference between yellow and blue, or sometimes the yellows can actually be sadder. And so when we talk about how, how colors lead to different physiological responses, again, that's outside of my area of expertise. But the work that I have seen suggested that it's largely influenced by the purity or chroma of colors and possibly lightness more so than hue. So the red, orange, yellow aspect of color.
We're talking with Karen Schloss. She's in the Department of Psychology and the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison, where she studies visual reasoning. Taking your questions about color and its influence in your world as you see it, 800-642-1234. Mary Jo is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mary Jo.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We can, yes.
Back in 1968, a friend of mine told me about a book by an author named Lusher. It was Lusher Color Theory. And it was all, you know, about the theory of how psychology affects people differently. And then this book had cards, different colored cards in the back. And you would pick out which color appealed to you the most that day and which appealed to you the second most that day. And then you could look up in the back what it said about your current state of mind. I'm wondering if the guest speaker knows about Lusher color theory and if scientists still think that's valid.
I do know about it, and I've got my first Lusher color book one summer after my sophomore year of college when I was up in Skidmore for the summer, and I found it in a used bookstore, and it was fun to play with. But I don't know of any scientific evidence that suggests that it actually is predictive of what it claims to be predictive of. So I think it's it was fun to play with, I would say, when I was exploring it, but it's not clear that there's how much science there is behind it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of these theories here, about 5 years ago, there was this neuroscientist who asked study participants what colors they saw when they looked at a dress. And that dress question, it went viral on the internet. It turned out that, you know, different people saw different colors, and that had to do with our understanding of visual perception. What did the whole dress phenomenon reveal to you?
The dress phenomenon is not a solved problem. There are still There are special issues of journals devoted to it. There are scientists who are still working on it. There are heated debates among people in my community about whether it's lighting or spatial frequency. So this was kind of the moment in the spotlight for vision scientists, where this was related to basic questions that we've been interested in for since the beginning of vision science. So it was exciting for the public to get interested in the same questions. One of the most interesting aspects of the dress is the individual differences component, the fact that some people saw it one way and could not see it the other way, and other people saw it a different way, and then it would flip. So we have examples of reversible figures. If you're familiar with the Necker cube, so it's a cube that you can see it facing one way or the other way, and you can get it to flip. But the idea that there are just these strong individual differences in color in that way was something that the field did not know about. And so it's led to a lot of really interesting research.
Yeah, and certainly, as you mentioned, just the armchair color enthusiast stepping up and saying, no, I see it this way. And it's almost like you have this built-in audience on social media being able to weigh in on some pretty cutting-edge research.
Absolutely. And to spark the cutting edge research.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you were talking about environmental theory, environmental color design theory. And I want you to be able to pick that up. What do you see there?
Do you refer to the ecological valence theory?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes.
Yes. So this is a theory that I developed with Steve Palmer back at UC Berkeley when I was a graduate student in his lab. And so we were trying to understand where color preferences come from, why they exist, why they change over time, why there are cultural differences. And I've been alluding to this throughout the hour, but basically the idea is that as we move about the world, we're continually forming these associations between colors and concepts. And when we judge how much we like a particular color, let's say UW Badger Red, our preference for that color is determined by how much we like all of the things that are associated with that color and the degree to which those things are active in our mind at a given moment. And so on average, people generally like blues most, and they like dark yellowish, those kind of rusty sort of olive-ish colors least. When I say on average, I mean also across cultures, even in Eastern and Western cultures. This is a bit different in non-industrialized cultures, though. But why would that be the case? Well, what shared experiences do we all have? We all have the shared experiences of clear sky on a sunny day, clean water. And it's really hard to come up with examples of negative things that are blue. I challenge the audience to try to think of negative things that are actually blue. Some people say mold, but mold tends to be more of a greenish color, not a blue, and that color is on average less liked. But like that really clear sky blue, it's really hard to think of anything negative. And in our data, people only listed positive things for that color. And then for this dark yellowish color, biological waste, rotting food. That's a shared experience that we have across the world. And of course, there are wonderful things that are these dark, like cornbread. that's great. But on average, the things that are associated with those dark yellowish colors are negative. And so that explains why across many cultures, people don't like that color. But
we have to pause there with Karen Schloss, who runs the Visual Reasoning Lab at UW-Madison. Still time for your questions about color, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with UW-Madison visual reasoning researcher Karen Schloss is here. We're exploring the intersection of colors and their meaning to our world. Let's bring in Nancy now in Janesville. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering, we have a grandson that is colorblind, and I wondered if that goes with anything else, any other kinds of syndromes or I just curious about it.
Yeah, Nancy, thank you for that. Go ahead, Karen.
Yeah, great question. To my knowledge, it does not, I don't know of any examples of it going along with other types of syndromes, and it's highly common. About 9% of the population has some form of color deficiency. And there's the cases that we call color blind, which comes from basically missing one type of the three types of sensors on the back of your eye. So instead of having three, there's two. But you can still be able to see the difference between different colors. It's just it's reduced. But then there's something called, so that's called a dichromat, meaning di meaning two. So you have two types of sensors. There's also something called anomalous trichromat. So you have all three types of sensors, but they're just they're too close together in their spectral distribution, which basically means more colors are confusable. So it's harder to see the difference between some colors. So there's, I think there's a lot more range of that than I think people realize. And it is quite common. And I don't know of other things that go along with it that would be things to look out for.
Do you screen for that in your studies when you work with study participants?
Yes, we do. So we have, it's called the HRR pseudoisochromatic plates is the type that we use. And excuse me. And it's a little book where there's shapes that are included in the in a bunch of dots. Many people have probably seen versions of these. And so people trace the shape with a paintbrush. And then if they can see the shape, that means that they can see the difference between the different colors. There are versions of these that you can create that people who are color deficient, they can see the shapes and other people can't because they rely on aspects of what they can see, especially luminance contrast, in ways that trichromats actually can't see the shapes. So I've used those in my class. And I use that as a way to, so I showed the example of the traditional plates, and then some people in the room feel like they can't see them, and other people can, because there are going to be some percent of the room that is color deficient. But then I like to include those so that those people who can't see the other ones can see these. So it's like, look, like there are things that you can see that other people can't.
Oh, that's so fascinating. Talking with Karen Schloss, who is in the Department of Psychology, heads up the Visual Reasoning Lab at UW-Madison. We're exploring how our brains see or don't see color, what that means for our world. Still time to talk at 800-642-1234. Karen, you wrote in the journal Cognitive Science about research that showed how color preference changed during different seasons. What is up with that?
Yes. So right before the last break, I had a but, and that's exactly what that but was. So nice job reading my mind. So although on average, people don't like those dark yellowish autumn colors, we find that people's preferences for those colors increases over the course of autumn and then goes back down in winter as the leaves have fallen. So what we did was we studied the exact same people each week for over the course of 11 weeks, starting in September, and then as the leaves changed, and then the last data collection was in December once the leaves had fallen. And so we found, and we took pictures outside each week to track the changes of the leaves. And we found that as fall was coming and as the environment was changing, people liked those leaf colors more. But it was predicted at the individual level based on how much people like fall activities. So if you're someone who loves pumpkin spice lattes and hay rides and Halloween and Thanksgiving, then your preference for the colors that are associated with those activities and objects will increase more over the course of fall than someone who doesn't like those things, because colors remind us of those types of activities and events.
Just seems like color carries so much baggage for us, so much history of our own lives that we have to take into account when we, you know, talk about color or think about color. And so with that, how do you like make colors very, how do you cut out that sort of association with colors and make them become associated for all people? And then I'm thinking about recycling bins, for instance.
Yes, so we've done some studies with recycling bins, and for us to be, I've been focusing a lot on individual differences this hour because I think they're fascinating. But we also do have these shared experiences that lead to average associations that we can use for visual communication. So in our lab, we have done a study where we ask people to start off by asking them to associate different kinds of recyclable concepts, so paper, glass, trash, metal, compost, with colors. And then we can use those associations to optimize the colors of bins so that if we then present a different group of people with those bins and say, which bin is for paper and which is for plastic and glass and so on, they can actually do the task without any legends or labels. And so this is really exciting because it means that we can make color designs that are more intuitive and easier to interpret on the average level. And that's when we're creating graphs and maps and diagrams and signs for the average community, and we want to be able to use color in a way that makes that communication more effective. And yeah. Evidence suggests we can.
It gives you a kind of a starting place, if you will. Let's bring in Tom now in Appleton. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I was hoping the guest could comment on various colors and in the brain, how it's processed, specifically when a color strikes an emotion similar to what you're currently talking about.
When color strikes a particular emotion. Tom, thank you. Karen, go ahead. Yeah.
Also a great question. So I don't know how color, in terms of neural mechanisms, how colors evoke emotions. A lot of extensive work has gone into understanding the visual system in terms of how we perceive particular colors, but then the neuro mechanisms of how going from that perceptive of a color to an emotion, to my knowledge, has not been. That's an open question.
Yeah. You know, there was the study out of Dartmouth where, they looked at how color influenced our peripheral vision, you know, how much color you see in your peripheral vision, and found that, you know, they removed up to 95% of the color and it didn't really matter for the study participants. So what does that tell us about our brain and how much our brain is filling in the color?
Our brain does a ton of filling in the color. So for the most part, so the center part of the retina, the fovea, is light projects onto there when you're looking at something. And so that area is very rich in cones, which are essential for being able to see colors. But there's evidence, as you said, that if you were to take away basically all of the color in the periphery, so you basically have a central dot that's chromatic, they're colorful, and the rest just basically is shades of gray. People don't notice. Work by Michael Cohen recently is beautiful work on that. And so what that suggests is that we are constantly constructing the environment around us based on limited perceptual experiences. We're filling in the environment in a way that if right now I'm looking at my screen, I feel like I have complete color access to everything in the room around me. And so it's very strange to think, well, if you were to just make the rest of it shades of gray, like a black and white movie, I wouldn't even notice, but evidence suggests that's the case. So the human brain is doing amazing things to be able to devote resources to what it needs to do, to what it needs, and then can kind of fill in the rest.
Well, we only have a few seconds left, but where do you see the future of color research, color communication going?
Great question. So in my lab, we are interested in trying to figure out ways to map the associations on average between all colors and concepts so that we can help automate the design for visual communication. So imagine that there's a website where you could query particular concepts and they can give you an optimal mapping that you could use to make different kinds of encoding systems easier to interpret, which middle schoolers could use in their science fair projects all the way hospital staff making encoding systems for filing to scientists communicating their data. And so that's something that we are hoping to do. But to do that, we have to be able to understand how people are inferring meanings from colors and what the nature of these associations is in the first place before we can actually deploy that for wide scale use.
Karen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Karen Schloss, Assistant Professor in the Department of Psychology and the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison, where she leads the Schloss Visual Reasoning Lab. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.